Asia Lecture Series. I'm Yoshika Vera, the director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. We have an interesting reversal of polarity in the room today, just to mix things up. Where our speaker is sitting on this side rather than that side, which is a nice flexibility that a non-PowerPoint presentation allows. Let me introduce our speaker, Professor David Nordstrom. He is Associate Professor of Occupational Environmental Safety and Health at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. He's also a member of the editorial board of the Board of Tobacco Control and Public Health in Eastern Europe. He has a great deal of experience in epidemiology and public health. He's the author of more than 40 research papers in peer-reviewed journals, and also a professional public health worker with experience in local, state, national, and international settings, including 5 years abroad with the United Nations World Health Organization and the Fulbright program. Today, the title and topic of his talk is Obstacles and Pathways to Conducting Research for Health in Eastern Europe, and it's our great pleasure to welcome you here.
Thank you. Dobry den. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to pass around some items. You can peruse the Ukrainian dictionary, Guide to Kiev, a report from Fulbright Ukraine in two languages, and the first print issue of the journal that was just mentioned. I think this issue is mainly in Russian, but there might be some English in there. So I've chosen five objectives to frame the context for the talk today, and I hope that there's a combination of breadth and depth in these five objectives because of the relatively limited time of an hour or less. First, I want to just mention the leading risk factors that explain the differences in mortality rates between the different countries of Europe. Spent a lot of investigation of how to understand why death rates in that continent would vary. Of course, a country is a bit abstract. It's a collection of many, many individuals in most cases, but it's useful to summarize mortality rates by nationality just to see if there are any important disparities between countries, or to look for clues that might tell us something that we want to pursue in particular populations, if rates are particularly high for certain causes or particularly low for other causes. So the World Health Organization, which is the premier intergovernmental body for public health in the world, has spent a lot of effort to try to understand what underlies these differences, and they've listed seven factors. You could call them risk factors, or loosely you could call them causal factors that account for these differences. They are high blood pressure, high cholesterol concentration, overweight, low fruit and vegetable intake, physical inactivity, tobacco use, and harmful alcohol. These are the most important known variables that are associated with variation in mortality by country. And one thing that the organization and other experts have done then is to look at what are some of the policy differences and what are some of the actual practice differences between Eastern Europe and Western Europe. Because it turns out that mortality rates are substantially higher in countries of the so-called Eastern Europe than in the countries of the so-called Western Europe, which, of course, may be arbitrary terms, but just speaking geographically, that's what we have. And one can say that countries in Western Europe invest more in public health research and in research publication. So they're putting more of their public investment into those activities. They also invest more in public health practice. including the prevention of disease. And finally, societies and countries in Western Europe put more effort into convincing policymakers to not only approve ways of preventing disease, but to approve the funds, to underwrite the costs of those strategies. So you see these major differences between the Western and the Eastern side of the subcontinent, but the continent. And probably those policies and practices are very relevant. The second thing I'd like to comment on is the current status of public health training and publications in these countries. I didn't do anything more in deciding which countries to use except look in the National Library of Medicine's term Eastern European and see what countries they put in there. And it ended up with 29 countries. I didn't add Mongolia, which I guess is part of Kriga, but except for Mongolia, I have all of the countries that are listed on the Kriga website. And I decided just to take one database that's used to catalog the world's biomedical literature. It's not, strictly speaking, a public health literature database, but Medline certainly is internationally renowned as a bibliographic database for public health evidence. It's certainly where one would like to go and look if one were wanting to know what knowledge exists on a topic in the public health field, or if one were trying to design a program or to design a scientific research study. And so we have Medline now currently indexing about 5,000 journals. How many of those journals are published in the 29 countries of Eastern Europe? And here you have a chart in the handouts that looks like this. And these countries are just arranged from Uzbekistan at the top, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and so forth, I guess all the stans, which have zero journals covered by Medline. And as you know, Medline is not an English-only index, so it's not necessarily because these countries don't publish journals in English. It's because the National Library of Medicine that decides which journals get covered or not has certain criteria for not only language and geography, but also scope and quality and so forth. It's not until you get down to Georgia where you find that there are some journals covered. And if you keep going down to Ukraine, there's a bar there that's a little bit longer because they have 7 journals covered in Medline. And then you have a competition between Russia and Poland, who each have 58. Now, one thing I want to say about these journals, and if you add them all together, you only get about 200 of the 5,000 journals, or about 4%. I've looked at many of the titles of these journals, and they tend to be extremely narrow, in my opinion. They tend to be in the basic science rather than in any applied science. So you don't get journals with words like public health in the field. You get journals like the Georgian Journal of Immunology. So you get very narrow scientific journals, very narrow, you know, in a specialized niche, and that's really what they're going to be covered for in Medline. So you have quite a disparity here within the region, right? You also have disparity between East and Western European countries because while Poland and Russia each have 58 journals covered, France has 100. Germany has 300. So you have these countries on the western side of the invisible, or maybe not invisible, you know, borderland who have much greater visibility in this widely respected and widely used database. Before I leave the second objective of my comments, I mentioned that as just one of many examples, if you take Germany and Ukraine, you can see that the rates in Ukraine of alcohol and drug disorders are 6 times the rates of the same conditions in Germany. And the rates of mood disorders, including depression, are 2 times higher in Ukraine. These data are not just based on evidence from medical records and clinic records. These data are based on standardized international, rigorously done health interview surveys, which are designed to estimate the current prevalence of these diseases without respect to whether they're being treated or not. Now I want to talk about some of the barriers to medical research in the Eastern European area. And many of these countries are of the former Soviet Union. Not all of them are. But here you have quite a long list of things that are relevant. Factors that are hurdles that Ukraine and other member states are going to have to figure out some way over or around if they're going to make progress in medical and health research. They're not in any particular order. I've seen some of these in visits to Ukraine. I've read about others. In some cases, I've both seen them and read about them. And one of my key informants is a person in Ukraine. I'll be speaking about her later. But she's a migrant from Russia who has resettled into Ukraine and has joined the academic field there. But one barrier, and she has emphasized this to me, is that in the former Soviet Union countries, many of the so-called academic societies still exist. The academic institutes, when the USSR existed, had this array of these academies, and you had these academicians who were favored by the state in their budgets and in their facilities and in their scientific freedom. And after USSR, dissolved, imploded, ended, now you have these new nation states, right? But you still have these academicians who every morning go to the academy and continue to draw their salaries and continue to have their budgets and continue to do their very, very, very traditional, narrow, specific investigations. And this is a problem in countries like Ukraine because universities do not have access to those research budgets. And universities do not have the scientific status that those academies have. So it's a dispute. Another obstacle in this part of the world is access to knowledge. Many of the libraries don't have large collections of journals from at home or abroad. And even the journals they have are often not electronically searchable because there aren't indexes to them. So if you wanted to find out in Ukraine knowledge on your topic, you might have to spend days and weeks manually reading old issues of all of these journals, if you could find them. You might have to travel to different libraries to even find them. With the foreign journals, you might be able to use an electronic database to search. You could use Medline, which is free to the whole world. But what do you do when you find an article? Sometimes you can get a free copy from Medline, but the majority of the time you can't. That article is for payment only. Or if you're, of course, if you're working in Western country, maybe your librarian will get it for you, or she'll have a subscription to that journal. But in Ukraine, I've met many doctoral students and faculty who are citing articles in their dissertations and in their own journal articles based only on their reading of a 250-word summary of the article. They've never read the article. They've only read an abstract. But they don't tell their readers that. They cite the article in their bibliography as if they've read it. So that's a drawback, isn't it? That's a drawback. The domestic journals in Ukraine are, according to my information, particularly weak. They tend to be published with lots of advertising for commercial reasons. You tend to get published in them on the basis of either paying the editor some money, because many of them openly charge money to get published in them, or knowing the editor personally, or knowing the people who are going to review your papers. And sometimes, according to my information, the reviews don't really make any difference anyway, because anything that will get submitted will be published as long as you pay the charges for the pages. So that may be another reason why there's only 7 Ukrainian journals covered in Finland. I don't know. Ukrainians can't travel except legally if they're wealthy, but if they're scientists, they're not likely to be wealthy. My closest academic colleague earns about $200 US a month. The only time she can travel abroad is if somebody pays her way. Otherwise, she can't. So there's no opportunity then to have conversations with other scientists. You think back at the history of science, how you had, you know, all those Europeans, you know, meeting in conferences and learning about genetics and mathematics and history of science and exchanging letters to all the learned journals, you know, and so forth and so on, and arguing with each other and, you know, studying physics and all those fields. That's really hard to do if you're Eastern European. You can't even go from Ukraine to Georgia just because you want to. And often the Ukrainians don't really want to go to Georgia because that's like going to a different part of Ukraine. They want to not even go to Poland, but to France or Netherlands or England or Germany, where there's more funding and more knowledge and more conversation and so forth. So there are 10 members of the 29 belonging to the European Union. So that's a bit of an advantage for them, because in theory, now they can get some travel funds from the EU, they can attend some workshops, they might get some grants. But Ukraine is not a member. And is not expected to become a member of the EU anytime soon, as far as I can tell. These countries, certainly Ukraine, lack national scholarly societies in any of the fields that would be relevant to this work. So when I visit Ukraine and I talk to my colleagues about, is there a national society of epidemiologists? No. Is there a national association for public health? No. Is there a Ukrainian Medical Society? So happens there is a Ukrainian Medical Society. What does it do? It doesn't do anything. It just has a P.O. box. So it's just something that's there, but it doesn't do any functions. It doesn't do continuing education or training or oversight or anything that's useful. Does it publish a journal? Yes, the Ukrainian Medical Society publishes a journal. Is it any good? No. It's more of a newsletter. It's It's more of a newsletter. It's more about the business of running a doctor's office or something like that. It's not really making any contribution to advancing population health or health policy. Training within the medical schools, of which there are about 18 in Ukraine, training in epidemiology and public health is extremely superficial. It may be as good as it is in some Western European countries. I don't know anything about that. But you get a few hours in your medical curriculum on epidemiology or public health, and that's it. I don't know what you can learn in a few hours about those fields. Just that they are fields, maybe you don't even gain respect for them if you're exposed to them so little superficially. There is limited government support for health research. So if you have an idea and you want to pursue it, how's it going to be funded? Most of the papers, most of the journal articles that the faculty of public health in Ukraine write, they write, they're based on secondary data analyses. So because some outside organization has done a survey in Ukraine, say on the risk of HIV/AIDS among injection drug users. Let's take that. That's a true survey. So they've surveyed, 500 couples, and they have some data. But they didn't do it for you, but they did it anyway. And they might be willing to share the anonymous data with you. Then you can do the reanalysis of it, reanalysis, and maybe get an article. There's limited access to biostatisticians to help study team. There's a great loss of Ukrainian population from the country. I was there recently, and I read a General magazine article that claimed just in the last few years, Ukraine's lost about 6 million people.
So where?
All over Egypt, Middle East, Netherlands, Western Europe, North America, Asia, wherever people can go. There's a problem in Eastern Europe that the perception of honesty in government is limited, and here's a second chart from Transparency International, a very well-respected organization based in Berlin that analyzes data from surveys that are done in various countries about how the respondents perceive corruption in the public sector. And again, some of the stands here are the most highly corrupt in the region. Up here, Ukraine is not far behind them. And then at the bottom you have Estonia and Slovenia that are over 60-65%. For comparison, the most clean, very clean countries in the 2012 survey were Denmark and Finland, who both got rates of 90 on a scale of 100. Sweden got over 80. The United States got over 70. So nobody got a perfect score, right? But I would imagine if you did a chart like this for Western Europe, the bars would tend to be longer. So you have a perception that government is corrupt. This really is not conducive to doing medical or health research. Because if you're going to get some data from the government or with the government, say data on death records or on clinic records or hospital records, how are you going to get those data? Who are you going to trust to give you those data? Are those data going to be valid and trustworthy data? What's it going to cost you to get your hands on those data?
data.
What is that person going to want in return from you? So you've got all these kinds of concerns, apparently, in countries of Eastern Europe, where the public sector is just not perceived as being that honest or that clean. The Soviet Union's history tended to neglect some fields that are really crucial. Epidemiology was one, statistics was one, public health was one. When the Bolsheviks were taking power, of course, they had this enormous typhus epidemic, which they had to put down. And the leaders in the party and so forth became really devoted at a certain time to communicable disease as a threat. And I don't want to say that communicable disease wasn't a threat or isn't a threat, because it was then and it is today. But it's not the only threat to population health, is it? And yet, the long history of the Soviet period and then the post-Soviet period has really tended to give infectious disease the premier level of attention. When I was most recently in Ukraine under a second Fulbright Award, I organized and led with colleagues there some workshops that were attended by mid-level university faculty, medical school faculty. And one of the things we did in the workshop was ask them what their scientific interests were. Everyone at the workshop was interested in communicable disease. There was not a single person who mentioned heart disease, stroke, cancer, road traffic accidents, or anything else. It was all about infectious disease. Is vaccine effective against infectious disease? With, you know, how much rabies there is. Every single one of these. And you could tell in the way they spoke that really they didn't. It wasn't as if people, I mean, I spoke with my Ukrainian professor colleague after the workshop. There didn't seem to be any embarrassment or any shame at all. So it seemed as if the people in the professoriate that attended the workshop were just, they just had absorbed this ideology that infectious disease, that's what it means to do research. You gotta have the microscopes, you gotta have the viruses or the microorganisms. That's what you do. So that's really going to be a limitation if you're trying to get your arms around something like diabetes, which is an emerging problem in countries like Ukraine that have a lot, dare I say it, overweight people. You got a rising tide of diabetes. It's going to be like a wave, like climate change. It's just rising and rising and rising. And if nothing is done to slow its rise, you know, the Eastern Europeans are going to wake up some morning and just see themselves engulfed in diabetes. Already they're engulfed in cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and stroke. So Soviet era also left behind some practices that still exist in Eastern Europe, such as having state secrets. I could never judge what was a state secret in Ukraine because I could never judge the claims. You know, I could read about them in the news media, but I would never know the secrets, so I couldn't judge if they were secrets or not secrets, and it was all pretty puzzling. But because of communism and because of the particular beliefs, I guess, within the USSR, certain things were closely watched and concealed. And such things were things that could make the system look bad, such as the number of homicides, the number of suicides. So those data during, you know, during the main periods of the Soviet Union just never simply saw the light of day. And then I've already talked about distrust in government and so forth, which has, it could have many sources, single sources or multiple sources, you know, communism, hunger, war, occupation, and so forth. Here's a handout some of you have. This is a memorial in downtown Kiev with the years 1932, 1933. On the front of the memorial, and then all these faces on the memorial, and this is to give memory to a period in the history of Ukraine when the Soviet agricultural policy that required peasants to provide certain kinds of quotas of grains to the state were in force. And if you didn't provide that grain, if you didn't grow it, and so forth, if you didn't share it, and so forth, then you might not be given seed, or what little grain you did have, even if it was necessary for you to eat, might be taken away from you. And people were not supposed to migrate to the cities either. So there was a lot of starvation and hunger and famine in Ukraine during this period, and a lot of people perished, not only in Ukraine but in other parts of the Soviet Union. But Ukraine is infamous for this particular horrible event, and of course the older people and the younger people learn about it today. They know about it, they remember about it, and this gets all tied back to government. May not be their current government, but it's still a government, right? And so it kind of feeds into that distrust of government. And then Ukraine was occupied, you know, Germans, Russians, you know, back and forth. So it was some hard times in that country, and then the brief attempt to be independent about 1918 or so didn't succeed, didn't last. So it was just, you know, like a little candle that was extinguished. And then they got independence again in 1991, but then, you know, since then there have been deep-seated disputes and arguments within Ukraine between different persons and groups and organizations about what course the nation should take, what course the society should take, what their language policy should be, you know, a whole range of arguments and disputes and so forth, till now you've got the former Prime Minister of Ukraine in a prison hospital under a long-term sentence. Because apparently the new regime didn't feel she negotiated a good contract with the Russians for gas. And there's a dozen or so other high-level people in her regime who are either indicted or in prison or in trial. And there's just a lot of bad blood. Kind of makes the gridlock in the United States look like children's party, in a way. So Ukrainians play for keeps. That's pretty serious. So anyway, you have those obstacles. Now, talk about, on the positive side, progress toward population health and education in Ukraine. And there's a map right there. And Just a tangent here. So this is one of my favorite pictures and places in Ukraine. You can find on your map near the place where Moldova and Romania meet Ukraine. You'll find on the map, it'll say Komenets-Podilsky. This is home. And this is really a delightful place. It's an old kind of fortress or castle. Very calm and quiet city. Far away from Kiev, but you can get there by train. So let me give some positive examples that I've witnessed in Ukraine, these things. I think most public health specialists in our country would recognize as advantages. They distribute free, clean needles to drug users. We don't do that. Only a few cities and counties that I know of in the United States do that. They have a ban on alcohol at work. Now, I'm not saying all these things are perfect, that they all are implemented, but these are, I was told, official policies. There's a ban on alcohol and blood of motor vehicle drivers, unlike our country, which has a ban over 0.08. Ukraine's ban is total, not a single drop. You can be cited, I'm told, by an officer for any blood. You have to be 18 to buy tobacco. Ukraine has ratified the International Treaty for Tobacco Control. I don't know if the U.S. has or not, but Ukraine has. For pedestrians, they have built walkways under the ground, so you don't have to cross traffic. You can go under the street to get to your destination. And they have an extensive mass transit system. They didn't have to do any of these things, but they did anyway. So I think they deserve credit for it. They also have some advantages to do scientific medical research. They participated in the Fulbright program even when they were part of the USSR. They had Fulbright scholars and they sent Ukrainians abroad under the Fulbright program. Not very many, but some. They have participated in international research through the National Institutes of Health, which gives them, you know, the exchange, a chance to collaborate with partners who have different experiences than they do or different tools or whatever. They have founded 2 years ago the journal that I passed around a copy of, and I've left the website name for you here. They have established a national school of public health. Now, Eastern Europe has about 24 allegedly schools of public health. I say allegedly because it's informal, you know. So Bulgaria says they have a school of public health. I take them at their word, right? It's not accredited. Nobody else has authenticated that it is really a genuine school of public health. But there is a European Association of Schools of Public Health. And anybody who thinks they're a school can just join it. So there's been some talk about accrediting them and so forth and requiring certain criteria, but right now it's just it's everybody in. But Ukraine did this in 2004. And it's interesting to me that they did it independent of a medical school. I'll talk more about the school later, but I'll tell you why I think that's significant. And then Ukraine has several libraries and institutions that participate in an initiative called INARI, which is a way that countries who meet the income criteria can get some access to some journals where they can get full text copies of articles. And that's a good thing. A few things about the school that I mentioned and about the Fulbright program generally in Ukraine. As many of you probably know, who's been on a Fulbright? But Fulbright has like a dozen different mechanisms for students, faculty, researchers, and others to promote interchange between American citizens and citizens of 150 or so other countries in the world. So, and I've been there a couple of times under Fulbright funding. 2004, this school was established. Now, this school, this is in an old part of Kiev called Kovil, down by the river. And the school was founded by some religious leaders, you know, centuries ago. But then, I believe under the Tsar and under the Communist Party, it was just shut down. We don't need this school, so we'll just not have it for a while. And then after Ukraine got its most recent national independence in 1991, then the school could reopen. And I wouldn't say it has a chip on its shoulder, but it sees itself as a little bit different. For one thing, it does not use the Russian language to teach courses in. When I was there, there was a well-known Russian epidemiologist from Moscow who was invited to speak on the campus. So I was told the faculty at this university in Kiev were having this big debate about what language he could speak in.
What is the language
instruction? English and Ukrainian. And so it depends on the professor and the class, but English and Ukrainian are both approved. They're both acceptable. But Russian isn't. So we're all waiting to see what the answer was. Eventually, I guess he was allowed to speak in Russian, but it seemed like it was kind of a big deal. So it's kind of a nationalistic, if I can use that word, kind of a campus. It's very Ukrainian. It's not religious, although it was started, it has a religious history. I would say it seems to me to be secular now. Ukraine's complicated, but I will say that it's private. You get some federal funding, some government funding, but essentially it's probably on paper it's private, okay? So anyway, in these Europeans, in like a decade ago, they did have a kind of a dating or matching program. So schools of public health in Western Europe decided we're going to match up with schools, embryonic schools in Eastern Europe, right? So they had some sort of a draw, and Ukraine got Maastricht, Netherlands. So when Ukraine started its national school of public health, they got Maastricht. So this is a formal arrangement between Maastricht and Kiev. And when I first went on the Fulbright Award in 2006, and I joined the faculty of this school for a semester. And about half the students, it was a master's program, okay, about 25 students. And about half of them were health professionals, mainly physicians, but some dentists and pharmacists. And the other half weren't, had no health profession at all. So that was an interesting class situation, of course, when you're talking about anything biologic or so. And I don't speak fluent Ukrainian or Russian, so I taught in English. And the students were supposed to understand English. They all had to pass an exam in English to get into the program. But in fact, they didn't understand me. Some of them understood me some of the time. So there was a lot of whispering, but we did not provide them simultaneous translation or anything like that. So I guess it was hard work for some of them who wouldn't understand what I was saying. Not only my English, but the way I speak English. So I have to give them credit. But my colleague, who is this woman who migrated from Kazan in the USSR to Ukraine, so she's a native speaker of Russian. She's resettled in Ukraine. She says her Ukrainian is pretty good. And because she teaches at this particular university, she lectures either in English or Ukrainian. So she kind of has a switch, and she'll go back and forth to some degree. But she doesn't like self-translate everything she says. You know, if she gives a lecture in Ukrainian, that's it. And frankly, some of the kids in the class, their Ukrainian isn't that good either. Because before the Soviet Union dissolved, many people in Russia, including very senior party members, did not speak Ukrainian well. So, anyway, and then the other way this academy is different is that it allegedly is honest, and that's unusual, I guess, in the country, because universities tend to, you know, if a student wants an A, maybe his uncle will come and see the professor. That means I can't prove it or disprove it, but those are some things I heard from professors in Ukraine. So, and then in 2008, the program added a doctoral degree in public health. So that was pretty fast, 4 years. And I said I was going to say something about the significance that it has no medical school. There's no hospital on this campus in Kiev. There's no school of medicine. There's no faculty of medicine. And what this does is it's the same thing that in our country, like when schools in like Johns Hopkins University started in Baltimore, Maryland 100 years ago, they started outside the purview of schools of medicine. They really saw themselves as like schools of sanitary science. And so in our tradition, we have grown so that we have some graduate schools who are outside medicine. And then you have non-clinical professors who feel a lot more comfortable and more welcome to contribute. So you have all your social scientists, your sociologists, your psychologists, your economists, your political science professors. And all those people can get into the public health field without having to wear a white coat with a stethoscope. And it makes for a different kind of atmosphere in the School of Public Health if you're, you know, under the thumb of the Dean of Medicine versus not. And this one is not. And so far, no other institution in Ukraine has decided to open a School of Public Health. So this one's got a monopoly, I guess. The problem is that the government of Ukraine does not see these graduates as employable. So when the government is trying to hire civil servants, and Ukraine is based, you know, it's basically an old Soviet-style public sector, so all the hospitals and clinics, medical universities tend to be public employees, right? So you need a clinic director, well, that's going to be a physician. That's not going to be somebody with a master's degree in healthcare management of this school. Unless he also is a physician, then he might get the job. But all these jobs are going to be reserved for MDs. So the school's taking really a bit of an economic risk because they're creating cadres for jobs that don't yet exist. And some of them have migrated to other countries. Some of them are just not working. Some of them are working for non-governmental organizations, like in the HIV AIDS sector is really huge in Ukraine, financed by money from outside. PEPFAR from USAID money is there and so forth and so on. So that problem isn't solved yet. There's two websites at the end there for people that want to check out Ukraine. Or Fulbright. And I think I'll stop there a little bit early and see what comments, reactions, observations you all can make about some of these issues.